Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
John Crossingham is a talented musician and songwriter based in Toronto, Ontario. Once the leader of a band called Raising the Fawn, Crossingham is an occasional member of Broken Social Scene and is one half of an explosive post-hardcore duo called Not Of. In July of 2018, No List released vinyl copies of Hypocritic Oath, Not Of's explosive and acclaimed second album, and the band has a few shows coming up as we speak. John and I connected a while back for a chat about Canadian politics and the current socio-cultural climate, the art pop of Raising the Fawn and his embrace of harsher rock tones in his own expression as he matures, his time in Broken Social Scene and an inspiring early show by Metz, some of the lyrical themes on Hypocritic Oath, What's Next for Not Of, and more. With the support of listeners like you who subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly pledges at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from CFRU 93.3 FM, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, which is home to Sonic Onion Records, this is the 459th episode of Creative Control featuring John Crossingham of Not Of with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, John, how's it going?
Hi, Vish. I am doing quite well. How about yourself?
I'm well. It's nice to see you. It's been a little while since I think we've been face-to-face.
Yes.
Probably like at a show or something.
Yeah. Hot Snakes was the most recent
one. Was that the one?
As I recall.
Were you at the one at the Phoenix?
Yeah, that
was an amazing show.
It was.
A weird night. Do you remember the night? It was the night of the election.
Yes, the Ford one.
Yeah. The Ontario election, yeah.
I should say. I think I went into the venue not knowing but fearing what the result would be, and kind of found out midway through and was grateful for some sort of release. It's odd in this time to be comforted. There was something interesting about being comforted by an election result, you know, by an American band.
That's right.
How many
they seem to know what was going on.
American elections have gone, you know, the way that they have. I think there was something they probably understood immediately.
I'm a little concerned about the fact that, and I count you and I among these kinds of people, like the progressive sort of people. I don't want to assume too much, of course, but it's weird that we keep getting blindsided by these election results? Because I feel like that was another one where there was a real sense that the left-leaning NDP had a real shot at mm-hmm. winning that election because everyone had written off the Liberal Party. They had essentially conceded prior to the race based on the polls. But there was, I thought, a sense that the NDP might win going into the night.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think some progressive people are informed, maybe well-read, maybe checked things out. But I, again, was not only surprised by the result, but the landslide of the result. Like, that was like a definitive vote. So do you have a take on that? Why? And again, I don't mean to lump us together.
I don't think it's too incorrect an assumption. Yeah. I mean, there may be some minutiae we disagree on, but I imagine we're pretty much on the same side of the ledger for most issues.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't surprised by it, but and I don't mean for this to be for me to appear like I haven't I've guessed it right over the last decade, 12 years or so. But I'm even going back to Rob Ford's mayoral election here and the recent presidential election in the United States and. And then what happened with Doug Ford here, I felt sufficiently wary of the chances of those people winning in every case and felt unnerved a little bit by the kind of overconfidence or dismissive nature that I think a lot of the left and progressives have had about those threats. And whether it's just sort of kind of that classic city people kind of looking down at rural rubes,
totally.
That sort of dismissive thing. Or even if it's this kind of 538, Silver stat stuff where I'm really informed and this is why it's going to break down the way it's going to break down and I've got it covered. You know, there's always been overconfidence in that. I think an inability to understand what is really important in terms of gaining power in this day and age and
mm-hmm.
keeping it.
Mm-hmm.
And also a real, very frustrating shyness about what one's true identity and assets are. And I think even looking at Mulcair's fate in the federal election, I mean, you could argue
that... He was the NDP candidate in the... Sorry, I guess there's people listening potentially from all over the world, so I don't want to...
Yeah. So Thomas Mulcair was the NDP candidate, so the further left, main further left candidate in the last... federal election that we had, which Trudeau won.
Yeah.
And you could argue that maybe the kind of cult of personality around Trudeau and the warmth and affection and all these people who were all kind of liberal all the time, they just had to check out for a while because of how much that party had bottomed out. I mean, you could argue that Trudeau was going to win no matter what Mulcair did. But this weird shyness about far left politics and what it means and what it could mean for the future of a country like Canada.
Shyness from whom, though?
Well, I felt that he ran. I'm a little foggy on some of the details, but I found that he was very. He felt more kind of center.
That is a recent thing. Everyone has played in America and Canada. They thought it would make sense, right? If you're trying to go mainstream, to go down the middle and appeal to both. But what we're seeing now is both sides are so entrenched, the left and the right, for lack of, and there's nuance there, of course, but I think people are more likely to get behind the people who are similarly entrenched and less willing to compromise.
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, we're reaching, I mean, the presidential election, I think, is a very good example of it as well, where, there are too many lists, too many reasons to kind of unpack on a list right now in terms of why Hillary lost. And misogyny is definitely a big one.
Sure.
There's no question about that.
Yep.
There's also how much she was tied up in not one but two past administrations, which carried a lot of baggage in that if you disliked Obama and or Bill Clinton, Hillary had to carry that baggage as well.
Yeah.
But I still, It's obviously unprovable, really, but I still hold firm to the idea that Bernie Sanders would have won that election had he run. But and I think
that's fair.
The reason for that is that he was left populist, and he was the kind of person, not Hillary, who would have been able to win in those states that Trump held that really cost the election. So states like Michigan and Wisconsin.
Yeah, yeah.
He had the
states
kind
she
of,
didn't visit.
Yeah. Yeah. And he won those.
Yeah.
In the Democratic primaries.
Oh, Sanders did. Yeah,
Sanders
that's true.
Did. He
yeah.
won those, and the Clinton campaign similarly was like, we're going to take Michigan. We've got it. Sanders clobbered her, and he clobbered her because he was tapping into the same, you know, a left-wing version of it, but he was tapping into the same kind of feelings and sentiment that Trump did on the right.
Right.
And I think that's where Canada, too, is in a lot of ways, you know, and so it's been bizarre. Trump's ascent, we had a preview of it with Rob Ford here,
and
no one really seemed to clue into that seriously. And then likewise, Doug Ford's ascent was predicated. You know, there was a preview of that in Trump in the States, and I think you know it's we Canadian and American politics aren't that dissimilar.
No, and certainly Ontario and American politics are not that dissimilar. Ontario might be a little microcosm of what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think within those two figures as well is this rise of anti-intellectualism, anti-expertise even.
I don't know.
I don't know what... You lived in Toronto and under Ford, right? Like you were here when he was the mayor.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do you... I often, whenever I visited and I was on the subway or something, I would look around and think, man, someone on here has probably voted for Rob Ford, and it would freak me out.
Well, I mean, I was just down in the States visiting my folks who have, they've had a cottage in the States for about 20, 25 years.
And I was whereabouts? Just,
near, on Lake Chautauqua, which is, it's very close to the Pennsylvania-New York border.
Oh, okay.
So it's about maybe an hour, 45 minutes or so outside of Buffalo.
Okay.
It's near Fredonia, which is, I think, actually where the Buffalo Bills have their training.
Okay.
Their, like, kind of summer training or whatever, preseason training and stuff. But I was down there, and, there a lot of this is projection on my part, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was and you're walking around, and people in pickup trucks and Eagle T-shirts and all this kind of stuff, and it that weight of the Trump kind of... momentum in the States. It was very unnerving for me, and I didn't feel comfortable. And it's as I know you're a parent. I mean,
it's,
I think a lot about
very hard. Yeah.
I mean, there's so many different places we can go with this. The Kavanaugh thing is very much on my mind. I'm guessing it's on yours.
Yep.
My wife has been almost inconsolable over the
absolutely.
Last little while.
Yeah, absolutely.
About what's been happening and the responsibility that I have to raise a daughter and especially a son in this climate.
I accidentally said that yesterday. I said, man, it's to my wife and maybe to a friend as well. It's just so unnerving for me as a father of a daughter. And then I stopped myself and said, actually, it's more unnerving as the father of a son.
Yeah,
he's the one I need to, and I'm not worried about him per se in terms of his demeanor or his civility or respect level. Like at this point, he's only 7, but so I'm not fearful of it. He seems to understand that, you know, certain personal space. We always talk about personal space and respecting other people's, when they say no, when his sister says no or whatever, like you respect that. And I'm not worried about it on that level, but yeah, it's very stressful as a parent to know, this is the world that's coming, as they get older and are more engaged with these kinds of news stories and why is this happening? And yeah, I wanted to ask you if you felt like this stuff that we're talking about is kind of conveyed in the music of Not Of in some way. Like, I come from a post-hardcore background where I was thinking about this as I was listening to your record, which is great, by the way.
Thank you.
It was awesome.
Thanks.
I was thinking about when I was younger and we would write songs like this. And I would spend time kind of writing, articulating my thoughts on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And then I would go play a show or we would make a record. And then I would just scream my head off, or we would scream our heads off. And so that articulation is kind of lost, that enunciation of the idea is lost in the roar of not only screaming vocals, but buried in the mix almost sometimes. Mm-hmm. So all of those things and kind of floated in my head. And I was thinking about Shallow, North Dakota when I would see that band. And I know you just saw them play a pretty rare reunion show, right?
Yeah, they literally played in Winnipeg opening for Ken Mode last night. So I think they're doing 3 dates with Ken Mode and then a run of shows. But yeah, I mean, that was for both Dave and I, my bandmate, our friendship was practically, you know, that was seeing Shallow and Kittens was kind of like a catalyst for us.
Yeah, this was a band.
Becoming friends.
Those were bands in the sort of mid-90s, and I kind of thought of them as part of like the Sonic Onion scene.
Yep, 100%.
Based in Hamilton, and you were in a band called Raising the Fawn that put out records on Sonic Onion, as I recall.
Yep.
So there's some kinship there. I just didn't know how much you loved. I didn't know Shallow, North Dakota was back.
I mean, that's a really recent thing. Like, I mean,
are they back?
I think they're playing shows and whether they'll do stuff. Biff, the bass player in Shallow, he has another band called Backbiters, and Nadav has played a few shows with them. And,
right.
And yeah, I mean, it was just kind of this out of the blue. It was like, yeah, I think we're going to do this.
That's cool.
It's our thing. And
did you play with them? Did Nadav play with Shallow? No,
we didn't. Well, I hope to soon, but if we can work it. I was going with this
was this notion of, you know, you're a thoughtful guy, and I know you from various other musical projects and bands that aren't, to my recollection, very similar to what you're doing in Nadav.
Yeah.
And now you're in a position where, as we were just discussing, you know, the world is pretty messed up. And all I'm asking is, how do you, if you, capture that within this band and the rage that I hear in this band?
Yeah, I think it's definitely in there. One of the things that I started off, like previous bands, a lot of my writing was very, very specific and personal. I mean, even the very first Raising the Fawn record was quite literally a letter to my wife. And
the
it was
thing.
Kind of like, I mean, it was basically like the lyric sheet was written out like a letter, and it was, you know, this 10 song thing that kind of tracked our relationship and various sort of ups and downs and whatever. So, you know, I mean,
this was before you were married?
This is before we were married.
Right.
Yeah. But, so, you know, I've always had that kind of element in what I did. And the whole thing with Not Of was, for one, this is pretty unlike any band that I had been in before, but I had been a fan of, you know, I mean, a lot of my favorite bands were things like Jesus Lizard and Drive Like Jehu and Jawbox and Fugazi and Kittens and Shallow, North Dakota. And I mean, I always loved all of these sorts of bands. I think I just didn't, I never was at this point where I felt comfortable accessing it as a musician. There were other things that I felt more comfortable doing. And really, one of the big things that got this going for me was, I remember going to see Obits at Horseshoe, and Metz
opened
show.
Up for, I was at that show.
Yeah, and
it was an early show for Metz on some level.
Yeah. I mean, this is well before, I mean, this is like 2.5 years at least before that Sub Pop record came out.
They had two singles out. Maybe the third one had been out by then.
Something like that. Yeah. So, you know, they were a little more kind of noisy and abstract, but it was still great. And my friend, John Drew, who's a recording engineer, he's done Fucked Up and Tokyo Police Club and a bunch of other stuff, and was actually in the drummer and Raising the Fawn for a while, too.
Oh, okay.
He was there, and he's like, I love these guys. They're great. Da, 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 da. And he'd been friends with Chris for a long time, and he was just talking them up. And I thought they were terrific. And this was kind of in my hiatus after I'd stopped playing music for a while.
Yeah.
And I was loosely writing things, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do next. And, you know, I was just busy raising a family and cooking and having a job and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And seeing them was just this kind of real shock to the system of genuinely like, oh, they're a bands locally that are making music like this. I had no idea, because everything that I was familiar with on the local scene kind of was sort of in, still in that social scene sort of radius, or, you know, things that kind of had come, had been birthed out of things like Arcade Fire and Social Scene. So these that kind of like multi-ensemble sort of art pop stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's three guys up there with their amps all cranked to ear bleeding levels, and they're just screaming, and, you know, and people were into it. And it was just like, that this is really inspiring to me, because I feel a kinship with this. And I was like, maybe this is what I'll do. And I'd always really enjoyed, I had in my head somewhere, I was like, I really like to do a duo. And Dave happened to be free. And Dave Dunham, we were friends for a long time. And he played in a band also on Sonic Onion called Chore for years. Mm-hmm. He was a drummer in Chore and just an awesome player. And I was kind of like, you know, he's heavy, but he also he's made his own like kind of synthy dance music and stuff. Big like techno kind of guy as well. Like real stickler for rhythm. And I was kind of like, if I'm ever going to play as duo, I really want a drummer who can just like hold it down.
Yeah.
And
why a duo, by the way?
I really thought it would be an interesting challenge.
Raising the Fawn was what, four or five people?
It fluctuated between three and four.
Three and four, okay.
So, and then Social Scene was obviously a million kind of thing.
Were you like you kind of came to Social Scene a little later in
I did, yeah. We had Raising the Fawn show, a Wavelength gig, and Kevin was doing a solo thing.
Uh-huh.
And we played, and afterwards he came up to me when I was working at Soundscapes one day, ran, hey, I really enjoyed that show, and we're thinking of putting something together, and it just sort of happened.
Oh, like Broken Social Scene hadn't started yet.
It had, and Feel Good Lost had come out,
right?
But they were kind of like, we want to put together a band to start playing some of this live.
Oh, so you were in the...
Let's put some things together.
Oh, okay, you were involved at that stage, you know?
Yeah.
Earlier stage. Yeah, I kind of think of you as joining a bit later in the band's trajectory.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because the You Forgotten People era, I was part of that recording of the whole record and writing for it, and then I left.
Oh, okay.
Because it was just silly now, but I left mainly because Raising the Fawn was about to start touring, and I was kind of like, I was going to go from, you know, just playing shows locally for the most part to suddenly tour, you know, two bands really going for it, and I just felt like I couldn't commit to both of them, and so I backed out, and they were, so, you know, Kevin and Brendan were like, you don't need to do that. And, you know, I only really needed to kind of look around and see, I mean, between Metric and Stars and Doomakes and all, you know, there are all these bands who are just, none of them were leaving the projects. But I just had this.
Even though they had the other, I see what you're
saying. This very Puritan-ish kind of responsibility and small town, I don't know, like where I was like, I should be there. And if I can't be there 100%, I shouldn't, you know, kind of commit. So I backed out. And then, you know, I became a part of the orbit again and did a bunch of tours, and sort of by time of the self-titled record coming out, I wasn't on that record, but I had been playing a fair bit, and then I was a full bore member of that touring band for about a year and a half.
You were on Letterman. You guys got to play Letterman. That's
I got to play Letterman and Conan, which was
unbelievable. Those are my heroes, those guys. So
yeah, it was I got to shake Conan's hand and all that stuff, and it was pretty exceptional. It feels, and every once in a while, if someone will bring that up, it's like, oh yeah. I was talking to an old friend from high school I hadn't been in touch with in ages, and he was just like, yeah, I showed my kids you on Letterman, kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know? And it's like, so yeah, it's funny. But anyway, how this all sort of relates to like playing in a duo, I just really wanted that the Spartan nature of it. And I'm also a bit of a control freak, and I had in my mind as this challenge where I was like, I really want to create a guitar sound where I've got even a good bass tone involved and everything, and, you know, from like a guitar kind of gear geek side of things.
Right.
I think I can do this.
Right.
I basically wanted to. I wanted to sound as powerful and impactful as Metz, but with two people.
With two people.
That was the whole idea. And Metz, especially the first record, them and Hot Snakes and a couple other things were like, and a bit of Queens, Queens of Stone Age and stuff, you know, some of their simpler tunes.
Yeah.
That was really the template for that, for the very first record that we made, Peak. And everything on it was, I was also, as a shorthand, I was sort of saying, like, I was trying to write dumb lyric-wise. And this isn't like a diss to any of the bands I've just named. But I always found, like, a better thing as opposed to writing dumb was maybe like more like write obliquely. I had a really hard time kind of avoiding being specific, I think, in a lot of the things that I wrote. So the first record, I was trying to write just like kind of impressionistic almost and use really guttural words and images and just kind of first instinct things, not over revise words. And
okay.
So really speak about stuff that was just blunt.
Well, what I was getting to earlier is when I was talking about how enunciation kind of goes out the window in this form a little bit, is that I feel like there's become a kind of template that makes it sound too rigid, but there's this template in terms of phrasing in some of this music that I think is interesting. Like everyone kind of at some point does the same kind of, I'm not going to mimic it now.
Yeah.
But there's just a certain kind of like, bah, 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 bah. Like, there's just like a way of singing.
Yeah.
And it suits the rhythm, the rhythmic, it's a rhythmic way of singing.
Yeah.
And it kind of matches the rhythm of a lot of what I would call post-hardcore music.
Yeah.
And so I think I know what you mean. Like, I think, and when you're in that zone and it sounds like when you started, you were inspired, but it was a little like you were emulating some of the things you were hearing and seeing to try to tap into it, because as much as you were a fan, it was sort of new. And by the way, Metz, the guys in Metz had been playing music in different configurations for a long time, but Metz really took off when they were in their early 30s or something like that, right? So they're older guys.
They are, yeah.
And I often think if I was in another band, it would sound kind of like Not Of.
Yeah.
Even though, like you, I would say there are multitudes in terms of music within me, right? There's lots of interests. And other times I'm like, oh, maybe I just write quiet things, you know, because it just depends on my day and my mood or whatever. And I don't do it very much anyway, but it's just something I've always thought of. It'd be cool to be in a band like that, you know?
That was really the thing. It was like, at this point in time, I just want to be in a band that's going to be really fun, because I don't have any illusions of it making money or being a big thing, and I can't afford to hit the road with it anyway. So I just want it to be really fun. And I think what I was longing for was something that had a release to it, that had a kind of like both sonic and emotional lyrical catharsis. And with this new record, I tried to push that more, like to be a little more articulate again with some of the things I was writing. And also, you know, I think the there are songs on Hypocritic Oath that could be on Peak, but there are a lot of songs that wouldn't.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to try and let a little more daylight in. I think now it's like Peak had a very vice-like grip on how it was conceived and its overall sort of
attack.
Attack for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, quite literally even. And I wanted to step back. And so that's where things like You Believers and The Goat and some of the more like instrumental and or sort of sound collage-y kind of moments and stuff came into play, whereas like I was just longing for a little more daylight in there. And I think it's been very telling that those are, for Dave and I, those are some of our favorite songs to play right now.
It's a fascinating record that way, because for every moment where I'm like, oh, this kind of reminds me of Flag Camp or the Jesus Lizard, by the end it sounds like Eric Chanel. Like there's like an acoustic kind of sort of end and conclusion, I suppose. And so there's this sense that it's a dynamic record. And like when I think of Raising the Fawn, that was, would you describe that as like a post-punk band? There was an intensity to Raising the Fawn that, like a mathematical, like coming from hardcore and post-hardcore, which had sort of this musical sophistication to it. I mean, that's what we kind of, I think like the whatever, like the jazz elements or whatever, mm-hmm. like the kind of time signature stuff and the intricate guitar playing and all that stuff. When I think of Raising the Fawn, that is what I remember a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like that was there for you, right? You seemed...
I think we were more like that live, for sure.
Yeah, live.
And some of the later records got more that way.
Yeah.
It started off as a real... I was really inspired by bands like Low and Codeine and
yes.
stuff.
Yeah.
And so it started off being a very like slowcore
right.
sort of band. And then it got more muscular. And I think also, you know, I was listening. There was this part of me too where I think like any concept, it started off being very clear mm-hmm. what the band was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then we made an EP and four full length records. So by the last couple records, it's like what we wanted it to be. I mean, I was listening to a lot of heavier stuff,
yeah.
you know, and so it was like I was listening more and more to things like Converge or, Aaron Turner's band Isis, and you know, just things that were heavy but had an artfulness to them,
yeah.
and I was kind of like, I think there are ways that I can graft this a little onto what we were doing. And in the end, you know, it kind of pulled that and just the overall exhaustion of touring and whatever kind of pulled the band apart in a way. But yeah, it led to some interesting stuff. But I think it was the heaviness was always really grafted on Raising the Fawn kind of forcefully. Mm. Whereas this, it's more the intent. And, you know, I want to create a band that is, musically at least, to people at their most sort of sonically overwhelming,
right.
I think, you know? I mean, I still want hooks. I still want groove. I still want riffs. I still, you know, it's like, I don't want it to, it's not meant to just be kind of noise, but I want there to be a lot of noise.
Yeah.
I want there to be a lot of kind of like the sound of things kind of being pushed too hard. And then lyrically, the themes are, you know, this record is not a concept record, but loosely it's kind of about looking in the mirror at oneself and not being especially pleased with what you're seeing.
Right.
And those covers a lot of things. And I've also, again, tried to write in a way where others can transpose their own sort of similar experiences upon it.
You were saying that one of the things that you viewed as a distinction between Raising the Fawn and Not Of is that Raising the Fawn was more personal mm-hmm. songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're saying that on some level, this Not Of record is a little bit of literal self-reflection.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think... But it's also meant to be something where I'm trying more, I think, with this to keep the door open for other experiences. So I'm trying not to, when I would write in Raising the Fawn, it's like, I mean, I struggle to think of an exact example of it, but it was almost like, I remember that, you know, that time you
sure,
walked into
sure.
the such and such cafe or whatever, you know, and it was
so,
like,
so
we really referenced.
One distinction, is it love songs versus another kind of personal songwriting?
Yeah, but also just that I try to pull back and, you know, how can I write more about what that.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Feeling is like, or that particular sort of conflict is like, rather than writing about a conflict. You know, what, you know, like the way that I think about it actually a lot, to kind of come a little back to what we were thinking about earlier about politics when and raising our kids in this sort of world.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was getting my haircut the other day, and I was talking to the person cutting my hair, and we were talking about Kavanaugh, and I was saying how when I'm trying to discuss these things with my kids, who are 11 and 5 and a half,
right?
So my 5 and a half year old asks, "Is Brett Kavanaugh a bad man?" I was like, "Okay, so where do we go with this?" And I was saying that I try really hard to speak about these things in ways that are not specific to that event. So I'm not going to say Brett Kavanaugh is a bad man because of this, this, and this. But I try to talk about, well, in this particular situation, this is the sort of job he's going up for.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, this is why it's an important job. This is why it's important for a person going for that kind of job to have certain qualities.
Mm-hmm.
This is why people are. So in other words, like trying to talk about not just about a specific event, but the general things that create that kind of political conflict and situation, and to inform critical thought.
Yeah.
So that whatever lesson is there, it's something that my kids can transpose onto a variety of situations and be like, so it's less, how do I understand the Brett Kavanaugh situation, but more, how do I understand navigating women's rights and, you know, sexual assault alongside this patriarchy, and what does it mean to be a bad man? What is male culture?
Right.
You know,
so
what is power? All this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to write with not of in that way too, so that it's less this is an exact me writing about this exact event. You know, I try to reflect a little bit more on how I'm feeling about certain issues, and then go, you know, what's my overall takeaway on that? So there's always, you know, You Believers was inspired by my uncle dying. Astoria Jack was inspired by a review that I wrote about a Beverly's record.
Oh.
And where I kind of, after writing it, inadvertently realized that I'd been kind of sexist in how I'd written about it,
okay,
while still trying to be supportive and kind of really like going, okay, so what is it really, you know?
When did you write that review?
That was like, I don't know, maybe 2.5 years ago, three years ago.
Okay.
But you know what I mean? So there's always a catalyst, but then I'm trying to write, hopefully, about like a larger...
Yeah, universal stuff.
A larger issue.
That might be more relatable.
Yeah, so You Believers was inspired by a particular thing, but it's really me thinking about how do you comfort yourself as an atheist in times of trouble?
Right. I see.
You know, I think that's really about religion as kind of a lodestone, you know, and a balm.
Mm-hmm.
BALM. And how I think a lot of people go to religion they need it most at a weak point in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And as an atheist, and a kind of a science guy, you don't get that same sort of comfort necessarily,
right?
When you know someone that you love passes, and you're looking for something to wrap yourself up in, and it's some sort of meaning, and why this happened, how do I make sense of it? And,
yeah, when you're an atheist, I suppose you, on some level, not in totality, but you kind of believe in nothing, on a faith-based level. Mm. And so when someone passes away, I guess you're forced to confront the fact that they have entered nothing, as opposed to thinking, if you're a religious person, you'd be like, oh, they went somewhere.
Yeah.
They went to somewhere, some other place. Yeah. But if your core belief is there is no other place, then that's a weird existential moment that only death or the threat of death, I think, can bring about. I wanted to pick up on something, though, that we were that's very fascinating. But do you think it's a coincidence that in this strange time, angry time, in Toronto and now in the world, that loud music is sort of one refuge for people like yourself? Like, do you think it's a, when I ask if anything in the air, so to speak, has entered not of, in terms of lyrical content?
Yeah.
But even the Sonic Attack, you saw Metz, that must have been 8 years ago or something, that show that we were talking about.
Oh yeah, at least, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So, and I do think that, you know, I think Fucked Up had a role in this too, but Metz in particular, in terms of noisy, pop-oriented rock music, they seem to kickstart something in the city. Maybe in some ways more than, I think Fucked Up probably, and bands like Fucked Up. And the whole, did you know like the Who's Emma scene in the 90s? Like, did you know the Who's Emma club? You were in St. Catharines.
I was in St. Catharines, yeah.
It's a Toronto, like, it's now Paul's Boutique.
Right,
in Kensington Market. Yep. But it used to be a venue called Who's Emma, and some of us would go there to see kind of underground loud music. And that's where I first met Mike from Fucked Up. So there was kind of this sense that, for me anyway, the same way, like, we try to trace, like, where did arts and crafts come from? Where did Three Gut come from? Yeah. Where were their hubs? Like, what fostered that? Like, was it Ted's Wrecking Yard? Was it Wavelength? What was it? And so I don't know. I don't mean to ask you to trace this, but I do think that Rob Ford and his ilk rose in Toronto.
Yeah.
Metz started to come up. People started to pay more attention to Fucked Up, also coming from a, maybe a, not the same, but a similar kind of place of hope-induced anger or something, like a sense that they wanted to change things, but it was coming from a forceful place. Do you think that's a coincidence that you gravitated towards louder music when things seemed to be going sideways in the world?
I think it's maybe a happy coincidence.
Okay. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, like I said earlier, I mean, these, Dave and I, our friendship was almost, you know, in some ways was almost formed over, you know, I remember giving him Yank Crime and
Drive Like Jehu album,
and him being like, you know, holy shit, what is this kind of thing? And that was, you know, bands like that and Jawbox and, you know, and again, Shallow and Kittens. I mean, they were a formative part. And this would have been when I was in, you know, like 19, 20, 21, 22, you know, like that really, my first band.
Your formative time.
You know, very formative. And Sonic Onion was just kind of starting. And so,
which was, I mean, a very eclectic label.
It was a very eclectic. I do think, Sonic Onion is a little unsung in terms of the variety of stuff that they fostered. I mean, if even just from Shallow to Hayden alone, it's pretty mind-blowing.
Tristan Cionic was an incredible band to see, and I like their records. Like, those guys sort of really start, Tim and Mark in particular were still working at Sonic Onion. And it was I think because it had a bit of a chip on its shoulder. It was like the upstart Hamilton label kind of pushing against the Toronto music industry.
Totally. And and as of someone from St. Catharines, I related to that idea this doesn't all have to come from Toronto or a major kind of center.
Yeah.
But I mean, so there's a part of it is like, oh, I'm finally getting around to this. But there is also a reason that I'm getting around to it now. Mm-hmm. And I think that it just makes sense to me as music now more than it ever has.
Yeah.
Because I'm not wrapped up in it because of a sort of like youthful
nostalgia.
I don't know. I don't think it's a nostalgia thing. And I'm also not in this sort of like youthful sort of petulance, you know, where it's like, fuck you, mom and dad. And, you know, it's
I
like,
think
you know,
because
it's like
yeah.
the, now where I'm investing yeah. in it, it's as a more of a mature person, a mature thinker. And like, you know, I think that heavy music is the artfulness of heavy music, I think, is really underrated.
Yeah, and
you know, and I think it has been for a long time, and I think it continues to be, and it is. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say other than it moves me.
Yeah,
and so I want to be a part of that community, and I want to be a part of that movement, and you know, it's still more, you know, more than ever making this record, especially finishing it off and listening back to it. It's still a place where subtlety can exist. It's still a place where you can express complex emotion. And I think that's the thing too. It often gets typecast as kind of something that is really just, you know, a hammer, you know, a very blunt instrument. And,
but there's a lot of nuance there.
I think there's a ton of nuance. And you know, one of my favorite bands right now is Sumac.
Right.
And, you know, he says as he's wearing a Sumac t-shirt, but, you know, but, you know, they're and their new record, I think, is a total masterpiece. And they did that an earlier record this year with Keiji Haino from Japan, experimental musician. And it's also great. And, you know, I remember there was a column in a Magnet, and when it was back page, you know, the back page of Magnet used to be this kind of like sarcastic, you know, really almost like the closest thing they got to like Vice style writing.
Yeah.
I can't remember who did it, but I remember he had this one column. It was around the time when Absence of Truth, the ISIS record came out. But he did this whole thing on kind of bands like that, where it's just like, what self-respecting 33 or 34 year old, you know, would be like, you know, would be like screaming and growling. And it's like, that's just for kids and everything. And on the new Sumac record, there's these, no doubt inspired a lot by working with Haino, but there's these vocal things that he's doing, Aaron's doing on a couple of tracks, just these howls, and they're incredible.
Yeah.
They're highly emotive, and there are lyrics there, but it's that thing where it's the way, just like any great singer, you know, and I am a fan of, you know, great singers, right? You know, traditionally great singers like Aretha Franklin and Sam Cooke and, you know, Al Green and Jeff Buckley and whatever, you know, it's like all that stuff matters, but it's a vocal expression. And there's one moment on the first track, The Task, it's probably about two thirds of it. It's like a 24 minute song. It's like two thirds of the way through it. He lets out this one howl, and it's just, you can't hear it and not register an emotional response.
Right.
It communicates something. And I think I'm only just starting to scratch the surface, I think, of what the two of us can do in this band I'm invested in between the guitar tone and what I'm trying to do vocally, I'm invested in more and more trying to uncover those moments. I want to make heavy music that, you know, it'll sound good, you know, it sounds good in a car and whatever, all that shit, but I also really want it to be, I want there to be moments that stick with people and that create a kind of that, you know, just set something off. Another one of my favorite bands for years and years, Low, just released probably the most sonically abrasive and bold record of their whole career.
Yeah.
And listening to that too, it's like they're just assaulting their own songs in terms of the production that they've done.
Yeah, right.
And the amounts of like distortion, and we're going to put this heavy, you know, cut out so that the vocals are just gone. And, you know, you, it's like maybe track 8 is the first moment on that record where you actually hear kind of vocal and guitar on its own. And you really can, you can hear it as clear as you would normally on a low album. And I think they're doing something there that is, I mean, it's art, you know, there's a brutality to it. And Michael Barclay, who I know you know as well, and great writer, great critic. When I was posting on Facebook about how much I love that record, he commented something to the effect of, that record sounds like 2018 feels.
That's what I was getting at. That's what I'm getting at, generally. Yeah. I feel like I don't have, it's impossible to generalize, but I think the uptick in sort of more abrasive sounds, even if sort of feelings and sentiments about this era are not articulated as clearly by some as others. Like the new Mudhoney album is the most blunt, overt discussion about what's going on right now. And I think other people, yourself included, and a band like Low, I think they're taking a more subtle approach to these sort of feelings and trying to articulate what's going on and or what they think is going on in the world and putting it into their songs. But I think, yeah, when a band like Low is starting to get more aggressive as they go on, I think that's a response to what's happening in the world a little bit. So that's what I was getting at with in terms of the rise of noisier rock bands in this city and around the world. I think it is one way of dealing with it on a both on a cathartic level, but also on a way of trying to intellectually deal with this shit. So,
I mean, the one thing I would say too, because I agree with you.
Yeah.
And I also feel like it's great to have these feelings and play in a band where I'm this feel of use to them. And, you know, so I'm not like, kind of like, oh man, the world is a fucking dumpster fire. And now I got to go up and sing these pop songs and I don't understand. Like, it's just, I can't get myself fired up to do it. I'm always fired up to do it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it feels very underground. Like, one thing, you know, when I look around at what people are actually buying and consuming, it's a very resistance-y sort of thing. It's a very, you know, and I think there are people out there who want it and they're craving it. But yeah, I also, like, guitars feel kind of dead.
They did. I think they're back.
I maybe they are. You know, I'm curious how much they're like, what the younger, I know there are some out there, but a lot of the bands that I'm thinking of, like you mentioned Mudhoney, and where, you know, I'm 44.
Yeah.
Guys in Sumac are old, Lowe's old. Yeah. You know, it's like there's a lot of old people who I think are getting into it. And I'm sure there are younger people playing guitars this sort of way, and but you know, there's a lot of pop music. I don't know. It's like I'm using an instrument in every sense of the word, you know, that is familiar to me and that resonates with me, and I've also tried to be very understanding of the fact that I'm of my time, and I'm that old guy playing my music now, you know?
Well, I mean, I will say I'm glad you are.
Thank you.
And I think the record's great and the band is excellent. What is next for you and for Not Of? And by the way, I mean, I've seen Broken Social Scene seem to be back. Are you part of any of that stuff?
Not really. No. I was talking to Kevin a bit, just texting him a couple days ago, and the one song I played guitar on the vinyl only bonus track on the last record.
Yeah.
That just came on Spotify. So if you want to hear Old Dead Young and didn't buy the vinyl, it's on there now. You can listen to it. But so, I mean, I'm sort of there. I mean, this is a whole other conversation. I had to get away from that. And it's nothing against anyone in that band at all. Yeah. I had to get away from like 99% of the time, I'm really happy with the fact that I left Social Scene in the rear view. And it could also be argued that it was going to happen anyway.
Right.
But when I see them sort of doing their thing, it's like, I get cognizant of the fact that I sort of sabotage that and through my potential to kind of play music at that level, you know, in terms of like for hundreds and even thousands of people kind of
sure.
night after night
sure.
and everything. But it's its own slog.
Yes.
And I know why I stepped away. So I root for them.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
yeah.
And I think I root for them, and I really love a lot of the people in that band a lot, and they've shown me a tremendous amount of you know, warmth and
sure.
support, and it's just my own sort of human fragility. I'm kind of like, I need to.
That's fair. No, that's fair. And I mean, you've got your own stuff going on, obviously.
Yeah.
So,
and, I mean, I think too, you know, it's like, I still remember being on tour. We were with Social Scene. We were playing a show in somewhere in, I think it was in Vienna. And we were just kind of in our own worlds getting ready for the gig. And I was walking around. I was listening to Cursed 2,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which I was obsessed with at the time. It had just come out. And I was just like, holy shit, this fucking record. And I remember listening to it. And Kevin was like, what do you listen to? And I put the headphones on. And he was just kind of like, just sort of gave the head shake and gave me the headphones back. And it's like, we're a bit of a different world.
Sure.
It's like the kind of music that I'm making right now, it is what I'm most happy with.
Yeah.
And it's like we're starting to work on new stuff already. And I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do it for quite a while.
It sounds like you're in it. Like both of you are on the same page with what it can be and what it is. So I think that's heartening. For people who don't know not that well, where can we send them to learn more about them? I know you have a Bandcamp page and a website.
Yeah, Bandcamp page. So notof.bandcamp.com.
Yeah.
Is really the best place to go. Both of our records are on there.
Yep.
And I think that's the best place to go.
I think
it's probably the best place. And, you know, like every other band, we have a Instagram and
sure.
a Twitter that I use fairly infrequently. I don't understand Twitter really, but but you know, it's that's the best spot.
Okay.
And both the records are on there, and also the No List store, which is our record label, who put out the vinyl for Hypocritic Oath and their old Winnipeg label. And in fact, they released a split between Kittens and Shallow.
Right, that's right. Oh, yeah, I have that thing somewhere.
Rhinoceros Love, yeah. Didn't really get a chance to talk about Lee, but he's been awesome. And,
cool.
You know, it's, and like us, you know, it's like he's been doing it the same amount of time. I think that's the thing. It's like I'm really found a community. And yes, we're older, a lot of us, but between, you know, Guys and Shallow and Lee at No List, and we've even kind of got to know a little the Jesse from Ken Mode a bit, mm-hmm. just over social media or whatever, but just talking about records. It's like, I think we're all, you know, there's a community of people who are similarly still in love with heavy stuff and believe there's a rich vein of stuff to exploit, and maybe we can't tour the hell out of it anymore, and
right.
you know, maybe we all have families and homes and other concerns, but if we stay reasonable about you know what we can put into it, it's like beer league rock and roll.
Yeah, it's like Weekend Warrior kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean. But yeah, it's like beer league, but it means everything to me. Like I'm fully invested. It's intellectually stimulating. It's emotionally satisfying, you know. And I think at this moment in time, you know, I need it.
Yeah. No, it's clear.
I need that kind of outlet, and this world does inform that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate you telling me about it. And
I appreciate you taking the time to listen.
Absolutely. Is there a song from Hypocritic Oath that we can go out on for people to hear?
You know what? I think because we didn't ever make a video for it, but it's probably my favorite, one of my favorite ones to play live. I think Dear Mr. Speaker, which is the seventh track. Okay. And was actually called Apocalypsis before. And I realized I forgot to change the digital code after we got
the metadata or whatever.
The metadata. So it still appears that way. It's like that's
what it says here on my phone.
Exactly. So
but it's now called Dear Mr. Speaker.
Dear Mr. Speaker. Yeah. Okay. And that's a whole other kind of story as to where after reading through Joe Gross's Fugazi book,
yeah,
which I did upon kind of recommendation of your podcast.
Oh, cool.
It's like that can be, you know, should still be around, you know, 15, 20 years later, and should this actually be worth kind of revisiting? That can be one of those stories where we're like, why was it called that? Where, you know, when did that change? On the metadata, it always said such and such and everything. So, but yeah, that's a favorite.
Okay.
For sure.
All right. Why don't we hear it and let people make up their own minds about what it might be about, and we'll revisit it 15 years from now.
That sounds good.
That sounds good to me. Okay. This is Dear Mr. Speaker by Not Of. John, thank you so much for being on my show and for making this record, and I wish you the best of luck with everything.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very special thanks again to John Crossingham of Not Of for being on this, the 459th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all iOS and Android platforms, and also on things like Spotify and YouTube and Audio Boom as well. If you want to find an episode of the show that you've heard about, but you can't find it on any of the things I just mentioned, go to my website. You can also go to my website to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter. There's lots to see and do on my website. There's actually not that much, but there's some things. There's the things I mentioned. Anyway, go to the website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly at vishkana. You can also listen to a radio show version of Creative Control on Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time around the world at cfru.ca on your phones or computers. Or you can listen to the show on an actual radio at 93.3 FM if you're in or near Guelph. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. We've had some come in of late, and I appreciate it. I'm not sure, maybe it's just me saying this at the end. I don't know, but I appreciate it very much. Thank you very much for your support of the show. Again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Thank you as well to my friend Jim Guthrie for lending me one of his songs. The rest is yet to come on this show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, last but not least, thank you very much for your support of this show by listening to it and telling your friends about it and subscribing to the podcast. It means a great deal. It means everything. If you weren't doing those things, why would any sane person be doing the things that I do? I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, thank you. I will talk to you very, very soon. Goodbye for now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.